There's a naval rescue submarine that resides out front, facing the Embarcadero at the Morro Bay Maritime Museum. It's a U.S. Navy DSRV, Deep Submergence Rescue Vehicle, dubbed the Avalon. It was first launched in 1971, along with her sister vessel, the Mystic. The DSRVs are 50 feet long, with a capacity to carry 24 passengers in addition to the crew. Utilizing U.S. Air Force C-5As and C-141 aircraft, the DSRV and its associated equipment and support staff could be dispatched to a port anywhere in the world. The vessels utilize technology and materials derived from the Gemini and Apollo space program. The DSRV was featured in the 1990 movie Hunt for Red October, starring Sean Connery. I'm correspondent Tom Wilmer. Come along and join me for a visit with Larry Newland at the Morro Bay Maritime Museum to discover the rest of the story, as well as an overview of the Maritime Museum's nautical artifacts. We'll then meet up with four of the former naval crewmen who served aboard the DSRVs. Larry Newland, the reason that I'm here has to do with a deep submergence rescue vessel that you have out front, built by the Navy.
Yeah, we have one of two DSRVs. They were going to build six of these vehicles and put two in three different strategic locations around the world. And of course, they only ended up building two, and they were posted at the Deep Submergence Unit, which is now called Submarine Rescue, on North Island, Coronado Island in San Diego.
And this was built by Lockheed?
Lockheed Space and Missile, but Lockheed had a division called Ocean Systems. Mm-hmm. And they worked on the Glomar Explorer, and they worked on a lot of things. But this was actually built by Lockheed Space and Missile in Sunnyvale, and then taken to San Diego. They had a lab down there, and they tested it some more.
This vessel became kind of legendary because of a Hollywood movie, Hunt for Red October.
Yeah, if you watch the movie, you'll see a few sections where they reference or even point out a DSRV. And what you're looking at in the movie is an 8-foot model, mm-hmm. that now hangs in the museum up at Keyport, Washington, which is the Naval Undersea Museum at Keyport.
So there were two that were built in the different names?
Yeah, one was the Mystic, mm-hmm. after, of course, Connecticut, Mystic Seaport. And one was the Avalon, and after Catalina. That's the one we had. Originally, they were just DSRV 1 and 2, mm-hmm. but then people felt like, oh, we should give them a name, so that's what they did.
And where is the Mystic today?
The Mystic is up at Keyport, Washington.
Okay.
Yeah.
Interesting. So tell us about the movie Hunt for Red October and how this played a role.
Well, in the movie, of course, they've got to get on board this Russian sub. The DSRVs were designed and engineered to actually mount the aft hatch of a nuclear submarine. What the movie doesn't tell you is that there's a specific design of that aft hatch. In fact, the Navy had a guy that worked full-time going around the world with all the NATO people that bought into the system to inspect and sign off on their hatch. Because you could buy into the system so that if you had a submarine disaster, you call on the U.S. Navy and they would come. So it's unlikely that the Russians would have designed their aft hatch. And in fact, when the Kursk went down,
right.
The DSRV was offered twice, and they turned it down.
Yeah. And that was because of ego and
a lot of things. I mean, this is you know, and who knows for sure if that would change today if we had our own system and we offered it to the Russians. I don't know if anything would be any different.
Right. So a question for you is the marrying and matching of the hatches.
Yes.
Did the Russians design their hatches so they would
marry? Somebody told me once that they went out of their way to actually make it so there was no way that you could mount a DSRV to one of theirs. What is it? They have the Akula class, and the Foxtrot class, and I can't think of the other classes. It's been a long day, but there were several classes of submarine. And of course, each side has drawings of the other submarines. We know exactly what it is, and they know exactly what we have. You know, so it was never used on a Russian sub. It was offered once, of course, with the Kursk, but never actually used.
A few weeks ago, you did a fundraiser, and at the Morro Bay Theater,
yes,
you played the movie mm-hmm. Hunt for Red October.
Yes.
And I went there, and you had invited naval troops who served on board that vessel and came and talked to us.
They did. Most of these folks were they were in the Navy, and they were assigned to the delivery program. So that's the program when a product gets transferred over by the contractor to the military, and they usually assign people. It could be a jet, a fighter jet, or a bomber, or a ship. There's some interface between regular Navy staff and the people that built the contractor. And those folks, as I understand it, were part of that delivery crew for both the Mystic and the Avalon, because they were only about a year apart.
So the DSRV is mounted right out front of the Morro Bay Maritime Museum.
It is.
And I imagine that's quite a draw. You have quite a few people that come in, and that's what piques their curiosity.
It is. And we've often been asked, what's the nexus between that thing in any submarine, for that mm-hmm. matter, in Morro Bay? And there is one. It's not really obvious, but if you look at our mission statement, it says Maritime History, Science, and Technology. Mm-hmm. And the technology in that submarine, which came out of the Gemini and Apollo space program, epitomizes nothing more than anything, late 1960s, early 1970s, Cold War technology. In fact, the computer that's in there to help it mount and land on the aft hatch of a distressed submarine is the same one that they used in the Apollo 11 program to land on the Sea of Tranquility. So it's a similar type of problem. Mm-hmm. You can imagine you're in the black abyss. You can't see anything. You got lights. It's a harsh environment. There could be currents and movement. And you have to land very precisely this big round thing on a large manhole cover. And how do you do that? That's a technical problem, and it was largely solved by Draper Laboratories, which is the laboratory assigned that's affiliated with the MIT. They designed the Norton bomb sight for World War II.
Oh wow!
So a big company like Lockheed, they have a project development team. But there's a particular project or a particular problem, they might farm that out to somebody that specializes in that. So they're part of the team. Sitting on the vessel Alma. This was launched in 1927, and this is kind of the signature vessel, almost a signature artifact of the museum. It's on our logo. It's carved on the front door, and it was an iconic waterfront feature from 1939 all the way till now. It came out of the water in the late 90s, around 2000. It was donated in 1995 by the last operator. We're the 10th owner. It was originally built for an Italian immigrant named Joseph Crivello in San Francisco as a fishing boat. And it was run by Standard Oil and Union Oil Company a lot.
And that's how it got down here.
It got down here. It got down here to work in the oil terminal that started in the late 20s off here in Estero Bay with the Standard Oil Pier.
In a moment about its hero status during the beginning dawning days of World War II.
Yeah, it's got a World War II affiliation, and a lot of people affiliate it as a World War II vessel, but she was a middle-aged girl by the time World War II came. In the morning of December 23rd, 1941, she was dispatched. She was dispatched from the Cayucas Pier because of the rumor that a tanker had been attacked by a Japanese submarine. And it had. It was the SS Montebello. And it was a Union Oil tanker, about 450 feet long, steaming from Port San Luis to Vancouver, Washington, full of Santa Maria crude oil. And it got hit on the forward starboard side by a long lance type 93 torpedo from the Japanese submarine, the I-21. We have a model of that submarine
inside. So it had just departed from Avila?
They had just left Avilev around midnight, and this was like 5:30-ish in the morning. And a couple of guys on the bridge, William Srez and Richard Quincy, saw something that looked like a snorkel or something sticking out of the water, and they said, better go wake the skipper. And he was a 46-year-old Swedish guy named Olaf Engström. And he got up and wiped the sleep out of his eyes and grabbed the glasses and looked at it and said, oh boy, start zigzagging and head closer to the coast because they'll run aground before we do. And they speeded up to like 10 knots because it's slow. And the submarine came out of the water on its starboard side with a rising sun flag on it. And one of them was remarked that it was a big boy, end quote. And it was. It was 350 feet long, and the tanker was 450 feet long. Wow. And it came alongside, lined up, and fired around at least one. Some people say two, but for sure one, because it hit the starboard side, shook the vessel violently, knocked the radio antenna down, did some cosmetic damage. And shortly thereafter, the captain ordered everybody to abandon ship. And so they got into four lifeboats and waited. The ship did not machine gun the lifeboats, as popular rumor said, but they did fire rounds at the side of the hull. And I know this because I've spoken with Dick Quincy, and he was sitting in a lifeboat. I spoke with him twice, and I have it on tape. He said, no, they fired that big 5-inch deck gun. And you'd see the register from it, and then you'd hear it slam into the hull. So they took a little target practice. You know, they're thousands of miles from home. They're not going to waste a bunch of ammunition and rounds on some guys, merchant marine guys, sitting in a lifeboat. They were of a disciplined Navy. They were told to come to the West Coast and wreak a little havoc.
So that SS Montebello, the tanker, sunk off of Cambria.
North of Cambria.
Yeah, and it's about 6 miles out.
It's between 4 and 6, south of Piedras Blancas, but north of Cambria.
And it's still on the ocean floor.
880 feet.
With oil.
No, probably not. Well, there was an investigation. Congressman Sam Blakesley, several years ago, sponsored a bill to get Fishing Game to hire a consultant to go down there and core drill through the hull and do some sampling. And they didn't find any remnants of oil. It probably still has bunker fuel in it, which is the fuel for the motor, but the power plant. And who's to say that the oil didn't meter out slowly over the years? But you have to remember also that the oil that you put in a tanker isn't like buying a can of 30 weight at the auto parts store. It's like tar, and they have to heat it. And so in Avila, when they pumped it, it goes through an impeller. They heat it with steam, and it goes through an impeller. Then it's pumped into the hold, where it kind of gels a little bit. So it's not going to pour out like motor oil out of a can. And at 880 feet and 50 degrees or 48 degrees, the consistency of that product is not going to be very viscous. But who's to say it didn't just meter out, or who's to say that when they did the core samples, they missed it?
Yeah.
So, as far as we know, it's not an impending environmental disaster, but attention was given to that.
Yeah. Before we go, a little bit more about the Maritime Museum, a couple of the other cool things that you have here.
Well, it's been open since 2017. I started with the project in 1992, and it's taken a long time to get to the point where we can actually have this piece of real estate and put it here. We have a building, a small building, very nice building with exhibits inside, and we have a model of the I-21 submarine and the tanker. The I-21 model is probably the best B-class submarine model in the world.
And that's the Japanese.
That's the Japanese submarine. And of course the tanker, and they're both the same scale, so you can compare them. We have several artifacts, and we cover everything kind of soup to nuts, from 8,000 years ago with the Salinan Indian maritime tradition all the way up to modern commercial fishing. There's a Coast Guard boat, rollover boat here that operated during the 80s. We have the DSRV. So we're a little bit of everything. And so I've always told people, you don't go to a museum like this to get an exhaustive treatment on the subject. You go there to get to provoke thought and to provoke an interest so that maybe you want to go learn some more about something.
To learn more about the Maritime Museum, Where's your go-to site?
There's morebaymaritime.org. You can just go there. They're open 7 days a week, 10 to 3. There is an email site. We do tours. Groups will get together, car clubs and schools. And every Monday during the summer, there's a youth program. In fact, there's one going on today.
Is there a cost of entry to the museum?
No, it's free. Mm-hmm. It's always free, but we certainly like donations. And I should say that this is 100% volunteer-run nonprofit. There's no money from the city whatsoever. In fact, we've given them money. We had to pay money for our own utilities to put power lines here and utility lines here. But it's completely run by volunteers. So we're always looking for volunteers. So let me make that pitch, Tom, right now. If there's somebody out there that would like to, even 4 hours a month, that would help. So come on down.
Larry Newland with Morro Bay Maritime Museum. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Tom.
My pleasure.
I'm Barney Becerra, a plank owner on the DSRV-2 Avalon. I reported aboard in January of 1970 at Lockheed Missiles and Space Company in Sunnyvale, California.
Wow. How long did you deploy on the DSRV?
I was on the DSRV from January of 70 until August of 1977. And I always say that I grew up on that boat because I went from an E-5 to an E-8.
What did you do? Was it mostly drill or?
I was, we were mostly testing when it came out of the factory, because when as a plank owner, you come out of the boat on the unit from the factory.
Uh-huh.
And there was a lot of testing, and of course there was a lot of failures and revisions done.
Right.
And we, the original crew, wrote the tech manuals and all the maintenance manuals, because there was nobody else to do it. There was only two of us, and we were the second boat. So we wrote our own instructions and our own maintenance manuals.
How often did you actually connect with a submarine?
Not very many times. I don't know. I'm going to guess maybe five times in the period that I was there. We did mother sub-ops. One of the problems with that was that you had to get a mother sub, a fast attack submarine that was, you know, combat ready, and you had to get them off the line to come and play with us. And it was, Sub-PAC really didn't want to do that, or Sub-LANT, the submarine force, didn't want to take a boat out of line for a month to play with us. So it was difficult, but we did do it. I did about five mates to mother subs. We never did a dis sub operation.
Dis sub meaning?
A distress sub.
Okay.
Thank God we were never used to rescue a downed submarine, but we were kind of ready for it.
And there was one based on the East Coast?
No. We were both in San Diego. The Mystic and Avalon were both in San Diego at the submarine rescue unit.
Uh-huh.
It was on North Island, which is an air station,
right. But
they had us there because if we went somewhere in a hurry, we were going to fly in on cargo planes. To begin with, it was three C-141s, and
so
then
that's
it migrated to a C-5A.
So that's how they transported
it. Transported to wherever in the world that we would be transported by plane, and then hopefully we would either meet up with a mother submarine or one of the ASRs, which was the Ortolan and the Pigeon. Ortolan is on the Atlantic coast. Pigeon was in the Pacific.
And again, ASR meaning
an ASR, a submarine rescue ship.
Uh-huh.
It was specifically built to carry the DSRV program.
Got it. But the DSRV, what made it unique was its ability to go to great depths.
The DSRV could do searches to 5,000 feet, but rescues to 2,500. We could only rescue to 2,500, but we could search to 5,000 feet.
My name's Corky Palmer. I'm retired machinist mate submarine, and I reported aboard to DSRV in July of 75. I spent about a year and a half there, and they had a need for a machinist mate chief on the DSV-3 Turtle, and I went there and spent 3 or 4 years on that vessel and really enjoyed it.
So we have a DSRV here in Morro Bay on permanent static display. Right. Did you ever drive that one?
I drove it on top when we were on the surface, because we had, when we surfaced, we had to have somebody to see where we're taking the boat, because they didn't have cameras that could work in the daylight. You know, they couldn't see well. So we call them a topside pilot. We'd tell the boat to go this way, that way, and stuff. So, yep, I got to do that, but nope, I wasn't there long enough to become a co-pilot. Now, Barney was a co-pilot.
Interesting.
I qualified as a co-pilot. I was a diver because it took four scuba divers to launch and recover the ship off of the Lockheed support ship that we had. I spent most of my time in as a diver in a wetsuit, but I was also the senior life support technician. So I would pre-dive the boat before it would dive in the morning, which took about 4 hours. And then the boat, then I would get out of it, get in my scuba gear and help launch it. And then it took four divers to recover it to get it back on the support ship.
Did any of the DSRVs were ever involved in an actual life-saving rescue?
No, they were not involved in an actual life-saving rescue. We practiced for it. And even with some foreign navies, the boat went to England
Scotland, I think.
We never did an actual rescue.
What they did is the submarines in other countries were outfitted
to handle
DSRV. So there was foreign submarines that could take us and have all the equipment on board they needed to have so they could go away and you know, rescue people.
The Russian submarine, the Kursk.
Yes.
We reached out to them and tried to give them help, but they turned us down, right?
That's correct.
If we had done that, it would have been a DSRV?
Yes.
It could have been, but the condition of the Kursk was such that there wasn't going to be anybody to rescue by the time we got there. There was a huge effort made to get over there to do it, but it was a lost cause, a very sad lost cause.
Didn't have to be.
Yeah, that's correct.
And who do we have here?
Stan Osborne, DSRV 2, Avalon, 1976 to 1981.
Very cool. And so you were based out of San Diego the whole time, right?
Uh-huh. I was a co-pilot out of San Diego. Did an emergency rescue out of Scotland. It was a flyaway.
A training revolution.
It was a training thing. And it happened on, it was Memorial Day, and the whole crew was out there having hamburgers and hot dogs and playing ball and getting drunk and and sunburnt and everything, and our beepers went off. We were required to have beepers with us 24/7, and our beepers went off. Fortunately, we were in Coronado, so it didn't take us too long to go back to the deep submergence rescue unit. And a C-5A Galaxy came in, and a C-141. We loaded it up.
How long to load a C-5A?
It took us only a few hours because we had been doing practices a lot. Right. So it only took us a few hours to get the tractor. We had to get a driver for the truck, tractor truck, and we had to have the boxes all filled up. We were practiced at it, so it didn't take us any time at all. Loaded up the airplane, and we were gone. Refueled in flight, landed in Glasgow, Scotland, drove off the C-5A Galaxy, went to Faslane, which was the submarine base in Scotland. They picked the DSRV up off of the trailer, the LTV, and put it on the HMS Repulse, British submarine. We launched. Now, we don't have any clothes. This is freaking May. It was May, and we're all sunburned and half sloshed. And, you know, anyway, we were freezing to death. So anyway, and they said, do not fall off the side of the submarine because you would instant death. The water was so cold. But anyway, we launched, went out to the area, found them, dropped the transponders, went back to the Dallas, recharged the batteries, went back to the downed submarine, transferred some people. It was all political and it was a test. Transferred the people, 42 hours. So the systems today, they can't even get the people together in 42 hours.
So tonight, we're at a movie theater, and they're showing The Hunt for Red October. In that movie, they feature a DSRV.
That is the Avalon. They called it the Mystic. That's another one of our little secrets, okay? They called it the Mystic. I don't know why, because maybe it was that way in the book. But it was actually the Avalon that they used.
In the movie, did it actually deploy? And did it actually connect with the submarine? No. It was all mock-up.
No, it was all mock-up. It was all AI, whatever you call it.
But it was actually based on that.
It was actually based on what a real DSRV and what it does.
So where are we today with DSRVs?
They got retired in 2009, was the last time that they were alive and operational. They decided not to put money into it again because people were more precious than the machinery. And they thought that what we were doing was too dangerous.
So today, okay, what's...
It was dangerous.
Today, what's the Navy protocol for rescue?
Right now, it's an unmanned vehicle. It can only go 2,000 feet deep. It's unmanned. It takes days, not hours, to get it out there. We went to meet the new stuff that was going on. What was that, 2 years ago? And we were so freaking amazed at how inefficient it had become.
Unbelievable, because they had people that wasn't stationed. We had, 16, 20 people? They had, this new system brings in people that are, reservists to a command, and they got to load up all this stuff and fly it away. And when it gets to where it's got to go, they've got to find a ship, and they've got to weld all this equipment down to the ship. The DSRVs was there and ready to go.
One more time, your name?
Corky Palmer.
All right, and tell us about some of your insights about the DSRV.
Well, we did, when I was on it, because being a plank owner, everything was new, and I was going to say one of a kind, but we were, because we weren't built the same as DSRV-1. There were some changes made.
And for the listener, a plank owner means what?
A plank owner means that you were on it when it was first launched, or when it was first built. And in my case, I was on it at the factory in Lockheed Missiles and Space Company in Sunnyvale, California. So we were there from from January of 70 till, I think it was about July was when it was for the school. And then we hung around while the factory was finishing the boat, because they were late and we didn't get done till April of 71. But and once we got to San Diego, most of the things that we did, it was just testing involved and proving the system out and fixing systems that failed that weren't designed properly. So there was a lot of changes made to the boat, and we learned a lot on the boat, and the engineers learned that it wasn't going to be as maintenance-free as they thought it was going to be. So there was a lot of work that we did. And we were also trying to find a real home. In San Diego, we had three different places that we were based at.
What was the final home?
The final was on North Island at the Submarine Rescue Unit. The original place was Lockheed Ocean Labs that was on Harbor Island. The second place was the interim rescue unit home port, which was on Point Loma at NOSC. And then the final place, when the building finally got done, was on North Island at the rescue units, rescue system, I think they call it now.
Have you guys been in the cockpit of the DSRV here in Morro Bay?
Yeah, we were
recently.
We went in today.
Pretty impressive, isn't it?
It's a memory.
A lot of memories.
We said, how in the heck did we get in that thing?
Apparently, we were more flexible in 1975 than we are now.
I remember Commander Dick Hall.
I was on the boat coming before you.
He was coming out of the control sphere, and I think he must have been like 37 or something like that. And he said, "I'm done. I can't. This is too much for an old guy like me."
What do we have here?
This is Merle Vogel. This is
Okay. We were factory crew of this boat, except when I was on it, it was just DSRV-2. Didn't have a name yet.
So you're stationed out of San Diego?
Yeah. And then 4 years, some 4 years later, after I left that boat, I went to the other DSRV and took it operational.
But again, they never moved one to East Coast and one to West Coast.
No, we were always stationed. The home port was always in San Diego.
We needed to be together. We didn't have enough people to do a launch and recovery for training.
Right.
We needed somebody from the other boat or somewhere.
We had two boats, two crews, but it was actually two boats, one crew. We intermingled a lot.
And again, if you had to deploy, you had to go, like you said, to Scotland or East Coast, how quick could you do that?
Well, tell them how long.
I told you the story about us doing, that was done in 42 hours.
Okay. All the way to Scotland.
All the way to Scotland, all the way to a rescue.
Mm-hmm.
Launch, recovery, rescue.
Flyaway first.
Yeah, the flyaway.
It was great.
Tell us a little bit about watching Hunt for Red October from the perspective of the DSRV.
They use the information, uh-huh, and they use some photographs and some stuff like that to make it look real.
Right.
But we never did do it.
Mm-hmm.
They just used the information. They filmed us, you know, and all that sort of thing. But they never did do it.
Interesting.
It was actually could be done.
Yeah. When you guys watch Hunt for Red October, what is there one most touching scene or?
We played a bigger role in Hunt for Red October. We played a bigger role in Grey Lady Down. The DSRV was more prominent in the older movie Grey Lady Down with Charlton Heston,
mm-hmm,
and David Carradine.
Interesting.
The Hunt for Red October was certainly a newer version, and it was it did show the way it would out, that it should have worked for a real rescue.
Yeah,
and a transfer.
It was launched from a surface craft. It wasn't launched from a submarine.
I was over in Honolulu interviewing the 4-star admiral who was common commander of the Pacific Fleet. And his PA said, you do know that he was the model for the submarine commander on the U.S. submarine. And he never once told me.
That was Chuck, right?
He was so modest.
Was that Chuck?
No. Thomas Fargo.
Oh, Thomas Berger, okay.
So I'd like to this. I just want to say, you know, to our surface sailor friends,
yeah,
I've asked them many times, how many types of ships are there in the Navy? They don't know, but we know are submarines and targets.
That's the two kinds of ships. That's right, submarines and targets.
The first time I went to sea on a submarine, there was a leak. I didn't know anything about this. I just stood back, got out of the way, and those guys just went about quietly, professionally, isolated that leak, and no fuss, no muss, and that really gave me a lot of confidence. I know that I'm with a bunch of people who know what they're doing, competent. I thought to myself, my mother would have been more excited about a leak in the roof, you know, than these guys were
on a
submerged submarine.
This has been really interesting, and we really enjoyed this. And it's interesting that people are really asking about this and want to get some information. You know, it is
caring so much about Avalon, too.
Yes, yes.
That's important.
My name's Corky Palmer. I was on a DSRV in July of 75 to March of 77.
Barney Becerra, I was on the DSRV from January of 70 until August of 77.
Merle Vogel, I was on both DSRVs, DSRV 2 first and then DSRV 1.
Stan Osborne, I was on the DSRV from 1976 to 1981.
You've been listening to the Lowell Thomas award-winning travel show Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, a featured podcast on NPR.org's podcast directory. You are invited to subscribe to Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer on NPR.org, iTunes, and more than 20 other podcast channels around the world. To learn more about Tom Wilmer's journeys around America and the world, log on to thomaswilmer.com.
This is Roseanne Cash, and I'm sitting here with Tom Wilmer. Please support your local NPR station. I listen to WNYC in New York. In fact, NPR is all I listen to. If I didn't have NPR, I would feel like my lifeline to the world has been cut. So, yes, please support your local NPR station.
Thank you.